Hello and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy, along with a cup of coffee, a drive full of files and some frantic trackpad action. Coming up this weekly, the show must go online as we click into some flesh and blood theatre that's been retooled for safely experiencing online. We hear from the Italian duo Varro on how they fell for Irish traditional music. Later on, Rob Long goes in search of quality laughter in his latest Martini Shot, and Maurice Gohan uncovers the joy in foreign languages, namely not speaking them. But first, we take another step on our journey into streaming art with film studies scholar Jennifer O'Mara. Together, we've been attending some of the torrent of arts and culture projects that have been forced to migrate online. This time, we're clicking on the Dublin Theatre Festival for two shows whose festival runs have been entirely online. Dead Centre Theatre Company's To Be a Machine, streamed to our desks live from the Project Arts Centre. And first, we visit YouTube for a new productions, The Party to End All Parties, inspired by the night in 1949 when crowds gathered on O'Connell Street to celebrate the Declaration of the Republic.
Our listeners will join us in asking God's blessing on this Republic and in praying that it will not be long until the sovereignty of the Republic extends over the whole of our nation.
In news productions, they tend to involve real public spaces. They often take place on the streets or in other venues like that. And so that aspect of it would have been the same, but you would have had relatively small numbers of people attending. And yet by streaming it live on YouTube, when I was watching it, there were up to 600 people watching at one time, instead of being guided around the city by these actors. Instead, they were acting directly to the camera, just doing presumably the performance that they would have been doing if there'd been people there. There is that sense of you're watching people kind of in the background and not knowing, you know, do they know they're being filmed? Do they know what's happening? Are they part of this? And I think it did lead to some really interesting moments. I suppose one of the things that I thought was particularly well done was the use of sound. There was a lot of layering of different kinds of recordings, particularly in the opening sequence where you have this woman doing a kind of interpretive dance to what is partly a kind of musical rendering of gunshots, which is being tied to the Easter Rising, and her body is responding very closely to these sounds of gunshots in terms of it looking, having an impact on her body.
That opening section, which was Nandi Bebe dancing, as we remarked when we were looking at the visual Carlo show, the format seems to really be very comfortable with choreography. It's something that we instantly feel like the liveness adds something to it, but the camera knows what to do with a body moving in a room.
She moves quite a lot through this building that they're in as well. So there's moments where the camera is just kind of following her, trailing her at what is, it seems like, a safe 2 meter distance. And then those other moments where she's alone in this quite clinical space, but she is making full use of it and sort of filling the room, so to speak, like it is a stage.
As long as we've been telling stories, we've been telling them about the desire to escape our human bodies, to become something other than the animals we are.
We look then at To Be a Machine, which is the other play, I suppose, that we've been attending this week, because both of these are sort of reactions of the Dublin Theatre Festival to the fact that, you know, they're not able to bring people into the theatre. And I suppose it made us focus on the way we're all talking, like you and I are talking at the moment over Zoom, and we have a lot more conversations that are mediated electronically. This is a piece that seemed to be in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, I think it was really, really fortunate timing. So this being an adaptation of Mark O'Connell's book from a few years ago, which focuses on transhumanism and is a kind of non-fictional work that focuses in particular on a lot of the transhumanist technologies coming out of the Silicon Valley.
Before we even headed to the theatre, there was a requirement from us as the audience.
It was an odd experience for buying a theatre ticket in that you didn't receive your ticket until you had uploaded 3 short videos of yourself following their directions. 5 seconds of you, you know, just looking at the camera, then wanting you to laugh for the camera for a few seconds, and then wanting you to close your eyes as though you're asleep. And so all this had to be done and accepted by them before you actually got sent a link. And the link itself only came a few hours before the show, because each performance was very much calibrated with the audience members who were attending. So it seemed to create a lot of work for them in actually figuring this out.
In our oldest written narrative, we find the Sumerian king Gilgamesh, who, distraught by the death of a friend and unwilling to accept that the same fate lies in store for him, travels to the far edge of the world in search of a cure for mortality. Long story short, no dice. We exist, we humans, in the wreckage of an imagined splendor. It wasn't supposed to be this way. We weren't supposed to be weak, to be ashamed.
I know you don't allow your image, a video image of you, to appear on the internet. So how did you feel about being required to do that, to go and see the show?
Yeah, I wondered how much, like, to what degree they would actually force it. Like, if I hadn't, would they have not sent me the link, or would they have just continued to send reminders asking me to upload things? It very much fit with the premise of this as a kind of technologically mediated theatre production, thinking about whether or not we need our bodies, whether or not we can have theatre without bodies. And a lot of it actually brought me back to, say, early cinema and people like Georges Méliès, who was known for trick photography and for kind of illusion work. And there was a sense of that very much, I thought, throughout, this sense of playing with our perceptions, you know, drawing attention to the potential to play tricks on audiences when they're not physically present, when we are kind of slightly compromised in terms of understanding what's happening and our role in that. So I thought they made good use of that.
When I was trying to work out what made these contemporary productions or even internet productions, the thing that's most striking is the way that we are brought into them one way or the other. In the party to end all parties, the we is sort of us in the streets, and those are our streets, and that's us walking around in some sense, and that's incorporated. And then into Be a Machine, the photographs of us are there. And that felt like there's a direction that might be interesting, like how do you blend people into the story in a way that's specifically allowed by being live on the internet?
Yeah, and there have been some interesting examples of this coming from cinema more than from theatre. There have been attempts to make so-called social cinema, where you had short streams of videos going up online, and there were opportunities for the audience to follow this kind of series over a period of time, but also to upload or audition basically for parts of it. And then they would be able to upload themselves doing, you know, lines and things like that. And they could be technically cast in this kind of production. So there is a sense in which maybe you could have more audience engagement by actually giving people a script, almost the same way we got prompts before to Be a Machine, in terms of saying, can you laugh? Can you close your eyes? Can you just stare at the screen? And maybe that could be taken further in terms of actually, you know, giving people lines to record or asking people to wear costumes, or, you know, really leaning into that maybe more. And that could be one way of kind of opening this up. It might bring in a different kind of audience, potentially more of the kind of younger generation as well, who are so used to and enjoy uploading content of themselves, you know, regularly to Instagram or YouTube or whatever. So that might be one way to make this work.
I was talking there to Jennifer O'Mara, and the next production we'll be taking in is Eternal, an online production from the Bram Stoker Festival, which starts on October 30th. BramStokerFestival.com for tickets if you care to join us. Next up, we have the return of writer and comedian Maurice Gohan, who's fled her Kilkenny lockdown for a studio somewhere in the south of France. Let's not judge. An ideal location to reassert her status as a proud, lifelong monoglot. Let's not judge. Instead, let's just look for someone to blame.
On my way back to London to resume the life I'd put on pause in March, I took a slight detour. And now I'm holed up in the south of France. with no return ticket. How bohemian. I love the south of France because I'm the type of person to say the south of France, instead of cutting to the chase and specifying the city I'm in. Sure, yes, I'm living in Nice, but I like the air of mystique and the sense of grandeur in saying, I'm in the south of France. I'm like Americans who visit Ireland for a week and talk about their trip to Europe. I don't speak French, which I didn't foresee as a problem. I lived in Amsterdam for 2 years and never learned a word of Dutch, and I got by fine. And I don't say that with pride. It's incredibly ignorant, I know. Languages just aren't my thing. When I try to learn, nothing resonates. It's like a foreign language to me. I got consistent C's in Spanish and Irish all through secondary school. I've never been able to grasp another language, so I've given up completely in trying. The first time I went on holiday abroad, we went to Spain when I was 12. We went to the type of place where everyone else was Irish and British, and you don't leave the holiday complex you're on for 2 weeks. Down to the pool, over to the restaurant for dinner, karaoke in the bar that night, and you just end up staying within the 100-meter radius of your apartment for 14 days. And then you come home sunburned and delighted. Lovely to experience another culture, wasn't it? You know what I'm talking about. On the first night, we got dinner in the same restaurant we would eat at for 13 more nights. It had a menu in Spanish, but in italics underneath were the English, and all the waiters spoke English. And because I had 2 years of Spanish lessons under my belt, my father thought it would be an A1 idea for me to place our order in Spanish. So I stumbled and stuttered and anglicised through the dos pollo con potatoes, patatas, and I mean, e. The waiter smiled or grimaced. It was hard to tell in the low lighting. Our Spanish princess, my dad screamed 45 minutes later when I completed the order, swelling with pride at my show of worldliness. His Spanish involved adding the letter O to the English words. Tu biro, please O, good man O. And the waiters understood him because they spoke English. I was delighted they spoke English. I was so happy to speak the most common language that other languages catered to me, learning my tongue. I remember sitting with my dad and telling him, I'm really glad the English invaded us so we speak their language. My dad slammed down his glass so hard, liquid flew up in the air. Blasphemy, don't ever say that. Your ancestors are rolling in their graves at those words. Sorry, oh. In Amsterdam, it wasn't a problem to not speak Dutch. Everyone spoke perfect English. In France, it's a bit more difficult. The French don't cater to us like the rest of Europe do. I have to Google translate everything and do a lot of pointing. Oui, that man's dish over there, merci. I'm living in a studio that opens up to a courtyard, and all my neighbours are French. None of them speak English. My next door neighbour knows the words hello, good night, and iPhone. He knocks on my door every evening and offers me a bite of his dinner. He offers the fork and smiles, and I always say no, merci, because COVID. And he gives me a thumbs up and says, good night, iPhone. In response to him, I know three of my own words. Bonjour, petite, and iPhone. Turns out iPhone is the same in French as English. Capitalism transcends countries, it would seem. We communicate in these five words and thumbs up and thumbs down. If we spoke each other's language, we might hate each other. But instead, he's one of the best mates I've ever had. Bonjour, thumbs up, iPhone. Hello, good night. The language of love, some call French. But maybe the language of friendship is iPhone.
Marie Scohan there on the international language of gadgets. Now, Asconigá and Bresci aren't the most common names among traditional Irish singers and fiddlers, but so what? We're not hooked on the ethno-nationalist vision of trad here. Consuela Bresci is native to Florence and Lucy Asconigá to Bordeaux, but they met when they got to the Cobblestone in Smithfield, Dublin. A few tunes later, their duo Varro was born. Their collection of tunes found and made explores feminism and rebellion, darned with harmonies, drones and counter melodies. Their latest project, a pre-lockdown dream, aims to bring together guests from Ireland's new folk scene, such as Lancome and Landless, for some site-specific music making. Chance to be a fine thing.
My name is Consuela Bresci. I've been listening to Irish music all my life. My dad is a musician and composer, and he has been working with a lot of Irish musicians since the 80s. His name is Antonio Bresci. He's been working with like Martin O'Connor, Dolores Keane, Van de Danann, and Ronnie Drew.
My name is Lucy Asconaga. I used to play in a band in France. We started playing with a fiddle player. His passion was traditional music, and especially Irish traditional music. He introduced me to that, and I completely adored it, so I decided to come to Ireland to try to discover a little bit better.
The traditional Irish music scene is really big in both countries. It got bigger and bigger in the last 10 years. You have sessions almost in every town.
If you want to find Irish music in France, you can. Obviously, it's not as much as here. You will have maybe one session a week or one session a month, depending on the side of the city. There are loads of festivals as well, so it's very alive. I think the best way to learn a music that is traditional is, it's not only about the music, it's about the culture, it's about the way the people share it. In Ireland, it's very specific. The fact that there are sessions in every pubs and that you have the opportunity to see absolutely amazing musicians. You're there sitting at the bar with a pint, and it's like you could pay 50 euros to see these guys usually, and they're just there playing every day of the week. Well, when I arrived here, I could not really afford to have loads of classes, so these sessions were my classes. I was just going there every day, and you can look at them play, see their different styles, the different techniques. Bit by bit, you learn what it is like to play Irish music.
Ye Jacobites by name, lend an ear, lend an ear. Ye Jacobites by name, lend an ear.
The album is a combination of songs and sets of tunes that we arranged. We've always been interested in songs that are told from kind of a female perspective, or at least where the woman is a little bit like powerful and not always treated like the victim.
What is right and what is wrong, by the law, by the law. What is right and what is wrong by the law?
In some songs where the woman is actually treated badly, we try to emphasize this by arranging the song in a way that is a little bit more dramatic than just a haha happy funny story with the woman is weak and all this. Anyway.
What makes it all in strife, fame the far, fame the far. What makes it all in strife, fame the far. What makes her always strive to end this husband's life? Or hunt a parent's life? Bloody war, or hunt a parent's life with bloody war.
We're also very interested in songs that are anti-war songs. So there is one that is called Ye Jacobites by Name, which is the first song of the album. There is a song called The Doffing Mistress, which is a song that
a female working song from Belfast.
Yeah.
So, and then we have five set of tunes. One tune is composed by us.
Come all of you Loughlin men.
About a month and a half ago, we released a video for that song. It's called Streets of Forbes. And it's an Australian song that tells the story of a bush ranger.
A bush ranger who threw misfortune.
And then after this, we decided that we wanted to compose a sort of outro to this song. This outro became a full tune. During the lockdown, I think everybody suffered very much of the isolation. and the lack of social interactions. It's great to play music on your own, but being able to connect with other people is extremely important. So we used to go to sessions and to have our own sessions in Dublin, and we had all these friends that were joining our session or were going to theirs and stuff. We thought, this is not possible. We cannot just wait for months and months and months to be able to play with other guys. So we thought, let's build up a project, a professional one, and see who would like to be involved with us. Amongst them, there is Ian Lynch and Cormac Dermody, who are part of Lancome. Then there is Ruth Clinton, Anna Mike, junior brother, Niamh Berry, who played with us on the tour and plays with us in Varro regularly.
Yeah, we're working only on traditional songs. We did a lot of research to be able to find themes that could relate to the experience of the lockdown. The themes are loneliness, isolation, relationships, being away from your family or home, the importance of friends and social connections, mental health, anti-racism, changes in societies. The project is to film these songs in unique venues, to film them and record it live, and then to go in a studio and record them after. We've been going into the process of arranging songs when it was possible to social distance meet, and now we're just waiting for the restriction to be eased.
For example, there is a house on Henriette Street. It's 12 Henriette Street, and it's a house that was built in the 18th century, so it has a Georgian kind of style. It's a beautiful, beautiful place, but it's also a little bit old kind of looking. There is 14 Henriette Street Museum as well. There is Killian Manor. There is the Tillen Chapel in Selbridge. There is Farmley House in the Phoenix Park, the conservatory. So every video is going to look very different, one from the other. This is a historical moment, and I know we're all sick to hear about the lockdown and all this stuff, but you might as well try to make something positive out of it. And the whole process of researching songs was really fascinating, because to be able to find songs that were written over the last 200 years, that you could still feel like it could be around today and they could reflect the stories that we have been through in the last few months, was very, very, I don't know, kind of overwhelming. We don't have enough money to cover the cost of all this, and we have launched a fundraising campaign. We're also offering, we're trying to be a little bit adventurous here, if some people would like to have music in their garden and with social distance when it's allowed, This is also a possibility. I'd have pulled the trigger, I'd have pulled the trigger and shot you.
Consuela Bresky and Lucias Conagar of Varro there. Louise McMahon was the reporter. VarroDublin.com for garden and other info. And to bring it all home again on this week's Weekly, Rob Long is here to pour us another martini shot. And for his latest epistle, Rob has been weighing the currency of his world, laughter in all its denominations.
This is Rob Long with Martini Shot. I have a friend who was once on a plane with serious mechanical trouble, emergency landing kind of trouble, fire trucks on the runway weeping in the first class cabin, that kind of mechanical trouble. And as they were coming in for what they hoped would be a safe landing, the flight attendant tried to get everyone on board to join in on a little chant. "We're gonna be okay," she chanted, clapping along rhythmically like this. "We're gonna be okay. We're gonna be okay. We're gonna be okay." And it never really took hold, apparently, and people went back to their quiet sobbing and their compiling lists of people they plan to haunt from the other side. Or at least, that's how I would spend those moments. The plane landed safely, but my friend told me later that the darkest moment of the experience wasn't the pilot's announcement that they were all in serious trouble or the woman in the next row who completely lost it, but the flight attendant's chant, "We're gonna be okay. we're going to be okay, which was when he and the rest of the passengers knew that probably they weren't going to be okay, and the whole experience was so much worse because of the flight attendant's cheer. And at some point, my friend just started to laugh. It suddenly struck him as hilarious, gruesome maybe, dark certainly, but he just couldn't stop laughing. He laughed uncontrollably all the way through the bumpy and terrifying landing. He laughed so hard that his fellow passengers were irritated with him for disrupting their shrieking panic. "Your laughter was really inappropriate," the flight attendant hissed at him as they finally disembarked. "I'm so sorry for ruining your near-plane crash experience," my friend said, "but I just couldn't help it." And that's the great thing about laughter, and the big reason most of the funny writers I know got into comedy in the first place. It's involuntary. It erupts. That's what we say. The audience erupted into laughter from some reptile part of the brain, which is why what we laugh at is often some sort of embarrassing thing, some bodily function or politically incorrect joke or unmotivated tantrum or an airplane heading for disaster. We laugh despite ourselves, which is just another reminder that it's not something we can always control. Unless we're in the comedy business, we can control it. For instance, there's a rule in comedy that we call the rule of three. If something happens three times, something explodes or somebody gets hit in the face or someone has to say something embarrassing or emotionally painful, and it happens three times in a row, then it's funny. It's probably not funny the first time. In fact, usually it's a lame joke or a silly pratfall. And the second time, it's even a bit tired. But by the third time, well, that's part of the joke. Can you believe we're doing this again? Comedy writers, especially those who work in collaboration with a lot of other writers, work very hard to smother their laughter. The trick to being a successful comedy writer is training yourself never to laugh at another writer's joke. Just acknowledge it, stone-faced, and mutter, "That's funny." Whenever I've heard a bunch of writers in the writer's room erupt, that's the word again, into laughter, it's always been over a joke or a line that simply isn't allowed on American television, or for that matter, in decent society. The way to get a comedy writer to laugh, uncontrolled, unmitigated laughter, is to say something so shocking, so over the line, so legally actionable that he or she just can't control it. It helps, I guess, to be on a plane that's about to go down and to have a desperate flight attendant telling you that you're going to be okay. "That's funny" is a sign of professional approval. It means that I acknowledge your talent and skill in coming up with a great line, but I refuse to feed your pathetic and grasping ego, which I know you have because I have one too, by laughing at your line. So instead I will mutter, "That's funny." Of course, writers tend to be diabolically resourceful when it comes to this kind of thing, and so over time they've developed an even more aggressive way to withhold approval. We call it the courtesy laugh. Someone says something funny, and you just give it a little courtesy laugh. It's actually devastating and very cruel, so only use it on your enemies, which, as we all know, are, in a funny way, also your friends. And that's it for this week. Next week, we go to great lengths to avoid a topic. For Martini Shot, this is Rob Long.
And during the meanwhile, why not make a visit to Culture File on Spotify, where you can find many more Martini Shots and laughs of every flavor. And that brings to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back again next Saturday at 6:30 p.m. and with the daily Culture File each weekday at 6:10 here on RTE Lyric FM. Till then, bye now.